Fleetwood Mac from 1973, back in the Bob Welch era, kind of a spooky vibe there. The song is called Hypnotized, and it fits the mood here. We're talking about the lost city of the monkey god. Douglas Preston is the writer, part of the expedition that went in. As we've heard in the first hour, they now have a lot of information that suggests something really is hiding there under the jungle canopy. Now it's time to go in. In a moment, when we come back, we'll meet the members of the team. Some very colorful characters that sound like maybe they're right from central casting. We'll be right back. So, Doug, the team is assembled. The plane flies over that area, T1, T2, all that. They come back with some images. You're there when the images come back and when the decision is made to take the next step. Talk about that moment.
Well, it was an incredible moment. It was May 5th, 2012, and the data had been gathered by these overflights of the Valley of T1. The data was uploaded to Houston from Honduras, where it was crunched by computers at the University of Houston, and then downloaded. And these three engineers from the University of Houston were, put the images together. And one of them came running out that morning. He looked like a raving maniac, waving his arms and yelling, "There's something in the valley." We said, "What is it? What is it?" He said, I don't even want to say. You've got to look for yourself." So we all rushed in, and it was one of the most stunning moments of my life. You did not have to be an archaeologist to see the pyramids, the great earthworks, mounds, the plazas that have been leveled in these mountains, the terracing, roads. It was incredible. We were looking at a lost city. It was completely unknown. No one had ever been there. No one knew of its existence until May 5th, 2012.
Oh, man. What a moment. So now the reality is setting in. We're going to go there. As you describe it, there's, in essence, a security briefing. They bring in some experts who are hired to go along with you, luckily. And these guys are the real deal, right?
They are. I mean, it took 3 years to get the permits to work, to get permission from the Hondurans. Of course, the Hondurans were also involved in the expedition. It wasn't just us. We had Honduran archaeologists with us and so forth. But it took 3 years, and in 2015, we all assembled in the town of Catacamas, which was controlled by a violent drug cartel. Wherever we went in this town, we had to have heavily armed soldiers with us. And I was talking to a Honduran who said that the cost of an assassination in Catacamas was $25. And was there anybody I wanted taken care of?
let me send you a list.
Yeah, really. I said, "Hey, I know a great place we can go to vacation, have a vacation down here in Honduras." But the team had hired three British ex-SAS special, special air services officers, military officers, who were experts, really among the world's experts in jungle survival and warfare, to keep us alive in the jungle. Andrew Wood was their leader. We called him Woody, a big, very soft-spoken British guy with a very sort of understated sense of humor. But I'll never forget that briefing in Catacamas, where he laid out all the dangers, and he said, here is what we're getting into, and everyone pay attention. And there was quite a long silence in the room when he was done.
So give me the list. What did he go through?
Well, he said, first of all, number one on the list are venomous snakes. They're everywhere. And at all times, we had to wear snake protection, which are these, what they call snake gaiters, sort of these things you wrap around your legs. The insects, they're scorpions. They're deadly spiders. There are bullet ants, that the bite of this ant is so painful that it's said to equal the pain of being shot with a bullet. Then there are many insects carrying tropical disease, and mosquitoes carrying malaria. kissing bugs, which bite you in the face. That's where they're called kissing bugs, which give you an incurable disease that eventually destroys your heart. You die of a heart attack in about 5 to 10 years. And of course, there are sand flies, which carry a really horrific disease called leishmaniasis. So he warned us about that too.
Well, we'll come back to that one. So it's insects, it's disease. There are the plant, just getting through the jungle, just walking around is pretty tough.
Yeah, I mean, the jungle is so thick that you can step 5 feet away and you're suddenly lost. And so we had to carry with us at all times a backpack with all the gear that we would need for an overnight stay, assuming that we were going to get lost. We also had to carry whistles with us. So as soon as you're lost, you blow on this whistle, and then they come get you. We had to worry also about quick mud. There are these holes and rivers of this mud that if you fall into it, it just sucks you under. It's like something out of a grade B movie. And very steep hills and thorns, ants that in trees where if you just touch the branch, tremble it, the ants fall down on you like rain and they bite you all over and inject a toxin which would require immediate hospitalization. I mean, he just went through this whole list. It was quite something.
In addition to these very serious SAS guys, you've got another indescribable character, I should say, unforgettable character named Bruce Heinecke. Tell me who he is.
Well, Bruce Heinecke was a fixer, and he was someone who had been working with Steve Elkins for 20 years looking for the lost city. He was married to a Honduran. He lived in Honduras, and his profession was drug smuggling for the Colombian cartel, archaeological looting, a murder, and gold panning, and whatever other work he could get. Paying work, he would get it. Now, this guy had, was running drugs for the Colombian cartel, and he got caught by the DEA. And they said to him, "You're going to work for us. You work for us now." And so he said, "Okay, I'll work for you now." So he goes back to the cartel boss that he's working for, whose daughter, by the way, he's dating. And says, "I was just caught by the DEA, and I'm supposed to be working for them now. So I've got to show some, I got to show them that I'm, doing something. So you got to give up a bunch of your people." So this Colombian drug lord gives up some of his middle-level people to the DEA, and the DEA thinks, "Oh, this is great. Bruce Heinecke is fantastic. He's really performing for us." And he played both sides for 10 years. And survived. Now that was something.
You say in the book that it was sometimes tough to pry stories out of him, but eventually he opened up a few of the adventures that he'd had. And it's right out of, I mean, he's a character out of Central Casting, a hard drinking, smoking, big, rough, tumble guy, who was a fixer who knew who to bribe and who to shoot. And you'd have to invent him if he didn't exist.
Yeah, he walked around with a wad of cash, and he was just passing it out left and right. He loved doing that. The bribery was a big show for him. But it's funny, he'd tell me these stories, and I'm a journalist. I was start writing them down. He'd say, "Hey, don't you write them down? I wish I could. I can't reproduce his language on air because it was so foul. But see, don't you write one thing down until I tell you can write it down." And then he would never tell me I could write it down. And finally, I said, "Look, Bruce. I mean, when am I going to be able to tell these stories?" And he said, "You can tell these stories when I'm dead. How about that?" And may he rest in peace. Bruce did die the year after, a year later, and it allowed me to tell all these stories.
So the team is assembled. You've got the images. You have the government permits. You find out, I guess, that the Honduran government is going to send some soldiers there because there had been signs of encroaching, I guess, environmental devastation that was inching closer to this site, right?
Yeah, there's a lot of illegal stuff going on, and one of the things that's going on is illegal clear cutting of trees, logging, and so forth. Now, this isn't just cutting down trees, but we're talking about people getting shot, a lot of murders taking place, fights over, illegal logging. You have a couple of people doing the illegal logging, they get in gunfights and, stuff like that. It's a wild west out there. So the Honduran government sent 16 special forces soldiers with us as protection, and also, I think, to keep an eye on us. They wanted to make sure that whatever was found, they were aware of. I mean, and they also brought in a Honduran archaeologist who was with us, who was a good addition to the expedition, a very smart guy. And in February of 2015, the expedition took off. Now, the only way to get into this valley is with helicopters. If you try an overland journey, if you survive it, it would take a month to cut your way through the jungle to get into this valley. And the valley is a very peculiar valley. It's about 20 square miles. It's quite large inside, completely surrounded by impenetrable mountains with only one point of access, which is a steep ravine or gorge, which the rivers that are in the valley all come together and flow out of this notch. So it's almost like the Lost World. It's an amazing place.
The Lost World of Conan Doyle. You would halfway expect to see dinosaurs running around.
Well, we wondered what we were going to see. No one had ever been in this valley. We'd flown over it, we'd look down, but you're looking into this thick jungle.
So describe the moment when you finally, you're not on the first helicopter load, but you get in there. Describe it.
Well, I was in the second helicopter load, and it was something. The helicopter comes in. They had previously dropped some soldiers who had macheted a small landing zone, just like a slot, very difficult to land. And the helicopter comes in, drops me and another guy off. They're three guys, but four guys already there, takes off, and, Woody comes out and hands me a machete, and I had my pack with me, and he says, go cut yourself a clearing in the forest and set up your stuff, your hammock and equipment, and watch out for snakes. So, you walk into this unbelievably pristine jungle, the trees 20 feet in diameter. It was like being in a cathedral that soared 150 feet into the air. The animals had not seen people before. They were not afraid. They didn't run away from you. In fact, they came into camp, curious. We had jaguars prowling about our tents at night. And I remember when I was setting up my tent, this troop of spider monkeys was in the tree above me. I didn't really notice them until they came down lower. They were furious that I was there. They came down, they were hanging by their tails and shaking branches at me and screeching. And then when I refused to leave, because, where am I going to go, they all lined up on a branch above me, eating what looked like popcorn. I don't know what they're eating, round little things, and stared at me for hours, fascinated. And I suddenly realized what it was like to be in a zoo, except I was on the wrong side.
So you're there, the unloading stuff. I would think, can you see ruins of the city, or is that out of view? And I would think, even if it is out of view, it'd be so tempting to go ahead and run over and take a look rather than set up camp.
Well, there was a lot of talk about that. Let's forget the camp. Let's just go look. We landed on one side of this little river, and the Lost City was on the other side, the first part of it. This is a large city. It covered like 2 or 3 miles of the river valley. But we're looking at this wall of forest. Behind that wall is the main pyramid in the city. But we had no idea it was there. You couldn't see a thing except just a massive wall of trees.
So how long are you there until you get to cross the river and go take a peek?
Well, it was, we had arrived late in the afternoon, so we had to set up camp. And that night, we had a a run-in with a very large snake.
There's a picture
And
in the there's a photo in the book of its head.
that was and that was before we saw The Lost City. Maybe I should tell you the story of the snake.
Sure. All right.
That was you know, when Woody had been talking about all the dangers of the jungle, I thought to myself, you know, he's just exaggerating because he wants to make sure everyone's really, you know, aware of what they're getting into, but he's really exaggerating. But when it became dark, and in the jungle, darkness is like being in a cave. You can't see anything. I had a little flashlight. I went to my hammock, got some stuff, and was coming back, and right underneath the hammock of one of the guys on the expedition was a gigantic snake coiled up in striking position, his head tracking me, and his little tongue flickering in and out. I'd walk by him twice. And so I backed up and I said, "Hey, you guys, there's a big snake over here." And so Woody and his two other guys came rushing over with the three people who were already there. And Woody said, "Oh my God, it's a fer de lance, which is the deadliest snake in the whole New World. And it's a very aggressive snake. It will sometimes attack you and it'll bite you, and then it'll chase you down and bite you a second time." It's not like a rattlesnake, which it's about 1,000 times more toxic than a rattlesnake. So, you know, you if you don't die from that snake bite, your life is over. Your normal life is over, because they're going to have to amputate the limb that was struck, probably. So Woody said, "I'm going to move that snake." And I thought, "I got to see this. How's he going to move that snake? He doesn't even have snake handling equipment." Well, he took his machete and he cut a 7-foot snake stick with a little fork at the end. And he moved in there, and in a lightning movement, he pinned the snake with his stick. And that's when the snake just exploded in a fury of striking everywhere. Its venom was flying through the night air. I mean, and its fangs were over 1 inch long. And it was bigger than Woody. It was actually bigger than he was, and he's a 6-foot guy who's over 6 feet tall. So Woody worked the fork stick up behind the snake's head, grabbed it with his hand, and meanwhile, the snake is trying to bite him, twisting its head around, trying to sink its fangs into the back of his hand and expelling venom all over the back of his hand, and his skin is starting to bubble. So he wrestled the snake to the ground, pinned it, and decapitated it. And even after he'd cut the snake's head off, the head continued to snap and spew venom, and the headless snake tried to crawl away. It was like something out of a horror novel.
He put the head up on a tree so to remind all of you to be careful, and that wasn't the last of the fertile lances that you saw.
That's right. He was after this was all over, he washed his hands, and then he said, "Nothing like that to concentrate the mind, is there?"
He really was trying to move it, though. He didn't intend to kill it.
No, he didn't, but he said that when it expelled venom on the back of his hand, he had a cut on the back of his hand. He said, "I needed to get that venom off my hand right away.
No.
I couldn't wait to move that snake. I had to get it off." So he killed it so he could wash his hands immediately.
So
And then
eventually, you're all anticipation boiling over. You want to go ahead and cross that river and take a look, but you were told, I guess, look, the first visit at least, it's an hour and that's it. What was the reason for that? I'll tell you what, we're going to be going to a break here. I don't want to interrupt you again. So when we come back, we'll tell you what Doug Preston and this team saw in the city, the lost city of the Monkey God across the river. It's something that they will never forget, and maybe we'll all get a chance to see here in a couple of months when the documentary film comes out. We're going to go into the break now with The Band and The Wait from 1968. David Crosby wrote that song, Crosby, Stills, and Nash perform it, Long Time Gone from 1969. So you can imagine the tension as after 500 years where no humans have set foot into this lost city, suddenly this team is right across the river and walking over to take a look. And what they found exceeded all expectations. It's tremendous. We can't wait to see the documentation, the document documentary itself coming out in a couple of months. We've got some of the pictures supplied by Doug Preston on the Coast to Coast website if you want to take a peek of the expedition. In a moment, we'll get into what they saw and the reaction of the world to their discovery. Amazingly enough, not everyone was happy about it. They get quite a bit of grief, in fact, from people who felt it had been done wrong, or the terminology was wrong, or the credit should go to other people. All kinds of grief. We'll get into that as well, and the consequences for our guest Doug Preston right after this on Coast to Coast. So Doug Preston, for the first time in 500 years, humans are walking into the lost city of the monkey god. Tell me what you see.
Well, we had to machete our way in. Every inch of that journey was won only through the slashing strokes of a machete. And when we entered the city, we couldn't see anything. It was really disappointing. The jungle was so thick that all we could see were leaves and big tree trunks everywhere. Even when we were, the archaeologist with us had GPS, which had screens on it, which showed the LIDAR maps, and he'd say, right there is the main pyramid. And we couldn't see it. We had to practically walk up to it and bang our heads against it in order to see it. So that was the first thing, was this really, that jungle was so thick that if you put that down in Times Square and put yourself in the middle of it, you would not have any idea you were surrounded by tall buildings. It was that thick. So it was disappointing. But as we started to explore, we immediately started finding things. We found a almost completely covered a row of altar stones, beautiful carved stones that were placed on tripods of white quartz boulders that were lining a plaza. And we could tell we were in a very level area. And then when we came to the pyramid, we climbed to the top of it. And, you could see that you were on some very tall structure. And at the very top, we were still so buried in the jungle that the treetops were still 100 feet above our heads.
My gosh. So are there, the first time you're there, it's only an hour, right?
Well, we only had an hour because the SAS guys made us set up camp and made us get everything in its proper place before they would let us go up into the city. They said, everything in camp has to be right. Everything has to be set up. We have to have our food. We have to have water. Your tents have to be up. Everything has to be buttoned down, and then you can go up to the city. And that the archaeologists were really pissed off about that. They wanted to go up right away, and so did we, but he wouldn't let us do it.
But eventually you start to you're able to spend more time there, and they start looking around and tell us the kinds of things that they found in that first burst.
Well, it was amazing what we found on the ground, the artifacts, that even though you couldn't see the buildings, you could see the artifacts on the ground, and it was absolutely extraordinary. The second day we were walking past the base of the pyramid and somebody said, hey, there's some weird looking stones over here. We all rushed over, and the first thing I saw was a jaguar head carved in stone, snarling with its mouth open, thrusting out of the ground, attached to something. And as we looked about, we could see that there are the tops of sculptures, stone sculptures, just peeking above the ground everywhere. An enormous offering or cache of stone sculptures have been left at the base of this pyramid. And there were big jars covered with snakes, and carved snakes and vulture heads and monkeys and things like that. They were big stone thrones that are very mysterious. They were seats of power of some kind with carved animals on them, and also decorated with strange symbols that look like glyphs. All this stuff just lying there. And that was just stunning to see that.
And this is not the only sort of city or settlement in this valley, right? The team figures out that there are several independent, I don't want to call them encampments, but different settlements.
Well, this is one of the things that is still being debated by the archaeologists. There are 19 large settlements in the valley that appear to all be part of the same city. sort of like neighborhoods in a city. And it's a bit like LA. It's more spread out than New York. So there's like concentrations of neighborhoods strung out along this river valley with fields in between and areas of agriculture and that sort of thing. But the debate is, you know, were these all part of the same city, or were these some of these independent villages or towns?
Well, give me the sort of the broad strokes of what it means. I mean, who these people were and what happened to them, because it is still a bit of a mystery.
But it's a huge mystery. First of all, these people were not Maya. Although this great civilization arose along the frontier of the Maya Empire, they weren't Maya. But they adopted a lot of aspects of Maya culture. They built pyramids like the Maya. They organized their cities in a vaguely Mayan way. And they also played the famous Maya ball game, the one, you know, where the losers often were decapitated, the losing team. So they played that ball game, which was actually a sacred religious ritual. It wasn't really just a sport. So the big mystery is, what was their relationship to the Maya? They certainly traded with the Maya. They probably fought wars with the Maya. But what other relationship do they have? Why did they borrow all these aspects of Maya culture? Nobody knows the answer to that. Nobody knows where these people came from. Also, they just appeared about 400 AD in this jungle area, and they started to build these cities. It got bigger and bigger and bigger, and finally by 1200 or 1300, they're building very large cities, like the one we found, which is the largest, huge cities. And then in 1500, they vanished just in the blink of an eye. And they were not defeated by the Spanish. The conquistadors didn't get anywhere near this area. This was too remote for them. So the big mystery is, what happened to them? Why did they vanish? And where are they today? Are there descendants in Honduras today? Again, a mystery.
There are hints that they just sort of walked away. That some of the artifacts that were found, it's just like they tossed their stuff in a pit and decided to split.
That's exactly right. When they excavated that cache of sculptures at the base of the pyramid, they found not 52 of them, but they found almost 500 of these sculptures. And they realized that they'd all been left at the same time and then ritually broken. And then the city was abandoned. So it appeared that at the very end of the lifetime of this city, something terrible had happened. Most of the people died. The survivors all brought their sacred objects, left them in this place, ritually broke them to release their spirits to go to the afterworld, and then they walked out. And then 500 years later, we walked in and found the objects just as they'd been left.
Of course, you know, the book has been written, and the documentary is coming, and who knows what after that, and the research continues, but you get to write the first story. You get to write the release to announce this to the world. That was pretty cool.
Well, it was amazing. It's an amazing story. You know, when I was a kid, I used to read about, you know, the H. Rider Haggard books about about King Solomon's mines, you know, all these adventure stories. And then to be able to participate in a very real discovery of a lost city, it's hard to believe that it could have happened, but I feel very fortunate.
Well, fortunate in one way to have been part of the team, and unfortunate in another, because you are still dealing with consequences from that journey. Tell us about that.
Well, I'll never forget, after we came out of the jungle, sitting by the pool with Steve Elkins, drinking a frosty bottle of beer, and Steve was mopping his brow, and he said, "Thank God we got out of there without anyone being bitten by a snake. Nobody died. Nobody got sick. I can't believe that we are all out safe." Unfortunately, his relief was premature, because about 2 months to 3 months after the expedition ended, we were completely covered with bug bites. All the bug bites faded away except one bite, which started to get bigger and bigger. And we, you know, I went to the emergency room, and the doctors looked at it and said, "Oh, it's infected. You need antibiotics." Well, the antibiotics didn't do any good. And finally, it was the National Geographic photographer who was with us on this expedition who finally took the photograph of this horrible-looking bug bite, which had turned into a weeping ulcer, really disgusting, took a photograph of it and sent it to a couple of other Nat Geo photographers he knew. And they wrote him back and said, "Hey, Dave, we hate to tell you this, but it looks like you've got leishmaniasis. And it's really bad. You better get yourself to the hospital right away." So Dave circulated his pictures, and we all looked at his pictures. We looked at our lesions, and we said, "Oh, my God, we've all got the disease."
Oh, man.
It's a really nasty disease. It's a flesh-eating parasite. It is incurable, unfortunately, and it's very difficult to treat. So we did not escape unscathed.
Is it manageable? I guess so. You're here with us. It's manageable to some degree, but it never goes away, huh?
Well, it is. What happened was that because it's such an unusual situation that all of us got sick, it turns out the valley is a hot zone of disease. And the legends all talked about the fact that anyone who entered the lost city would fall ill and die of disease. And of course, we just dismissed that as just a bunch of, you know, superstitious, you know, legends. Well, it turns out that that legend was actually based in the truth. The valley is indeed a hot zone of disease. We were only there for 9 days in the jungle, you know, in the site itself, and yet two-thirds of the expedition came down with this horrific disease, including the Honduran soldiers with us. So even they weren't immune to it.
So the curse is real.
Yeah, it was crazy. So we were all treated at the National Institutes of Health. They were fascinated with us and our disease. We were very popular with the doctors. So it was nice to be wanted. So they treated us there for free. We actually had all our medical expenses taken care of because we were enrolled in a very important medical study to try to find out, you know, what this disease exactly was, how best to treat it, and so on and so forth. And they did find that we had an unknown or a new variant of the disease that no one's gotten before, that's never shown up. And it's unfortunately a very one that's very hard to get rid of. And the treatment itself is really awful, and it makes you feel like you're dying, you know, just to be treated.
Well, hang in there. So the lost city of the monkey god is discovered. The news goes out all over the world. You would think the archaeological world would be thrilled. I guess a big percentage of it was. And then you get naysayers and nitpickers come out who attack it.
Well, you know, any time you do something that makes a big splash, that people are excited about, you're always going to get those people who say, "Wait a minute, what? This is, you know, the naysayers and the, as you say, the nitpickers." So there were a small group of archaeologists who were very upset that this discovery was made not by archaeologists initially, but by engineers. They thought it should have been made by archaeologists. And they didn't like the technology of LIDAR being used to find this city, because LIDAR is very expensive. They said, "We can't afford LIDAR. This is not fair. You found this, you know, city using LIDAR. It's way too expensive for archaeology." And, you know, these are older archaeologists who, this is a new and very disruptive technology. And like everything else in the modern world, you know, it's disruptive. So they were against it. They came out against it.
Well, and some people, as I remember from the book, complained about the terminology that was used, or that you had discovered it, or that the terminology used to describe a civilization, as if it took Americans or foreigners or whatever to conclude that something had been discovered.
There's a certain level of political correctness in the vocabulary used by archaeologists today that, for example, you're not allowed to use the word discovery anymore. Because it's insulting to the indigenous people who actually built these cities to say that we discovered them. You're not allowed to talk about civilization because that implies superiority. Just use the word culture instead. And you're not allowed to talk about lost cities because that's a throwback to the old Indiana Jones days of archaeology when, you know, the great archaeologist would arrive and make a discovery. So there were archaeologists who objected to us using that kind of language. But the fact is that we have a language called English, and those words are common English words. And you can't banish words like civilization, discovery, or lost city from any kind of discussion of these things, because what words are you going to replace them with? I mean, it's absurd. Now, you know, my book, The Lost City of the Monkey God, is not an archaeological tome. It's not written for archaeologists. It's written for people who are interested in this stuff, you know, intelligent, well-read lay people. You know, it's not for scientists. So I use those words because they're common English words, and I'm don't feel that it's right to twist the English language up into knots trying to be politically correct.
You know, I read the same adventure books that you did as a kid, and it fantasized about this kind of thing and think it would be pretty cool, but it was, I'm not sure I'd want to go into that jungle just for the bug bite part of it. Tell me this, you're not allowed to pick up souvenirs and bring them out. I would think that there'd be security around there. At least I hope there is now. What becomes of the lost city of the monkey god?
Well, the Honduran government has excavated that cache of sculptures, although they're still working on it. There are many hundreds there. It's quite a job. And they're taking the pieces and they're going to an archaeological laboratory where they're being studied, photographed, stabilized, put back together because some of them are broken. And then they're going to the National Museum of Honduras. Some went to the Presidential Palace, and a whole bunch of them were put on display at the American Embassy so that Americans who are in Honduras can see them. And they're really amazing objects. They're just stunningly different, interesting, beautiful objects. And a lot more is, I mean, they've only excavated 200 square feet out of, you know, several square miles. So there's going to be a lot more found in the coming years and decades in this lost city. We've only really scratched the surface.
And you said the documentary will be out in, what, 6 months, something like that?
Something like that, 6 months to a year, that documentary will be out. And I am sure there'll be more discoveries because, in fact, just this is something that hasn't come out yet at all, but I'll tell your listeners about it. A Conservation International sent a team down there to study this valley, and they said it really is like a lost world. One of the rainforest biologists who was there was just weeping. He said, I've been studying the Honduran rainforest all my life, and I've never seen anything like this place, where the animals have never seen people, where he had a mountain lion walk right up to him and stare him in the face, and then crouch down and look at him, and obviously thinking, you know, food or not food. And then, thankfully, decided not food and walked off. But so there's so much to discover. But they found a species of bat in the ruins, which only live in huge, deep caves. And they said, oh, it means there are caves around here somewhere. Now, we do know that these people buried their dead in caves. They did not like to bury them in the ground. They put them in caves with all their grave goods and objects.
So that might be a discovery still to come. Douglas Preston, the book is called The Lost City of the Monkey God. I really enjoyed it. I hope you'll come back and we can talk about this again or whatever you've got in cooking. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
We'll be back in a moment with Simeon Hine. Chuck Berry, the rock and roll pioneer, takes us into the break.